Thank you for downloading this Hay Festivals podcast. For more information about the Hay Festivals globally and to access our archive, please visit hayfestival.org. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Thank you very much for coming. This is a real treat. It involves a wonderful historian who is a great writer, teacher. He was a politician and has now become, to my great delight, and I can say without any sense of reserve or irony, to the great delight of the entire nation, the director of one of the most special, inspiring, and thrilling buildings on earth. His name is Tristram Hunt, and his fantastic building is the Victoria and Albert Museum. You're going to see a very short film about the museum, and then you're going to hear from him. He will take questions for 20 minutes and then has very kindly agreed to join us signing books in the book tent next door afterwards. I know that you're going to have a wonderful hour. Please join me when he walks on after the film in giving him a very warm hey welcome. Thank you very much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Thank you very much for that warm welcome. My name is Tristram Hunt, and I have the enormous pleasure to be the director of the Victoria and Albert Museum, the world's greatest museum of art, design, and performance, home to 2.3 million objects and some of the most creative, intelligent, productive people you could possibly hope to meet. We are based in South Kensington, and what I thought I'd do this evening is explore some of that history. Because in February 2017, I was lucky enough to be appointed director. Now, at the time, some people slightly unkindly asked, what possibly could I have brought to the V&A, having formerly been a Westminster Member of Parliament, working in a Victorian edifice surrounded by gnarled historical artifacts? Or why, as a Labour politician, was I so interested in curating the wonders of past glories? But I have muddled through. And indeed, as good a training as I thought the Parliamentary Labour Party was, it did not compare to the first Keeper's meeting at South Kensington. But of course, the differences are vast. And what has struck me at South Kensington at the V&A, is even though we are involved in curating thousands of years of the past, this is actually an institution far more focused on the future than the past, than Westminster. In Westminster, the buildings seem to generate a sense of nostalgia about the past, whereas at the V&A, as you've seen, we are intimately involved in addressing history, but don't seem to be so cloying about elements of that heritage. And I've also found that as a politician, there is a room for transference of some skills, above all focusing on the public and the needs of the public and what they want from this institution. But the big difference, I think, is that as a politician, even if you're in the shadow cabinet, even if you're in the party, you are also, as a member of parliament, in a sense, a sole trader. As the director of an institution like the V&A, what you are is a custodian of an institution in which, yes, you will show leadership, but it doesn't really belong to you, as some of the volunteers at the front desk are very keen to tell me that they've seen directors come and go, young man, and we hope you're better. But above all, really, it belongs to you. So what I thought I'll do this evening is talk about the founding purpose of the V&A, explore what we do now as a museum, look at some of the collections, set out some of the challenges which UK museums face today, list some of my ambitions as director, and then crucially hear your thoughts on the museum and its direction, because what I've also found is that lots of people have lots of thoughts about the V&A, which is welcome. So the first director of the V&A, a man called Sir Henry Cole, who we shall meet in a minute, described the museum in 1857 as a refuge for destitute collections. Sir Roy Strong, being Roy, called it an extremely capacious handbag. And others have called it the nation's attic. But there were some strategic foundations to the museum. And let me begin by touching on three. The first is the East India Company collection. The habits of the British in India in the 18th century and the habits of the East India Company were, yes, about trade and conquest, but they were also about collecting, understanding, and referencing, partly in a sense to govern India. And just as Napoleon in France, Napoleon in Egypt extracted the intellectual and cultural riches from Egypt and brought them back to France to show the nation that the French approach to civilization was so much more powerful than where they were conquering, so in Britain we were doing the same with the riches of India. And in 1799, the East India Company repository was established with three fields of collection, originally established by Warren Hastings. First, a cabinet of natural productions, and then artificial productions, and then miscellaneous articles. These then became the India Museum, which after the 1857 rebellion transferred to the V&A. And the highlight, of course, of this is Tipu's tiger, which is known as the Man-Tiger Organ. And this is an extraordinary piece of work of French and Indian design, which Tipu Sultan, the governor of Mysore, commissioned. And it shows a wind-up tiger organ devouring a British soldier. And so when the British stormed Seringapan and crushed Tipu Sultan, this was one of the riches that came back, and it proved a huge hit in South Kensington, as you can imagine. But what we also gained was an incredible collection of fabrics and textiles. The riches of Bengal came back to Britain, and much of that was brought back to South Kensington. And so we now have one of the world's great collections of Indian textiles, but more than that, we have right from the beginning of the Victoria and Albert Museum a very strong connection with South Asia, with Indian diaspora communities, and artists and designers from India. Most recently, we're proud to host Subodh Gupta's installation When Soak Becomes Spill here on the Exhibition Road. His reflection at the V&A on legacies of colonialism, materialism, and economic inequality. Our second driving force was the design school movement. In 1836, the Select Committee on Arts and Connection with Manufacturers was adamant that the principles of design should form a portion of any permanent system of national education. Sir Henry Cole, our founder, was even more blunt. He wrote, "Straight lines are a national want. Unless you begin with the child and teach him the ABC of drawing, you have little chance of establishing any permanent system of art instruction in this country." And right from the beginning of the V&A, instruction and education has been a key function of our role in the world. We emerge from this concern about the levels of design education and technical expertise just as the first industrial revolution was beginning to come to an end in the 1830s and 40s. And rather than just supporting fine art, the aspiration was to set up a system for teaching industrial art. So the Government School of Design, founded in 1837 in Somerset House, London, fed into the V&A. And then you had the design school movements. And here is one picked from random in Stoke-on-Trent, the Wedgwood Institute in Burslem, which was part of this network of design schools which had the V&A at their heart. And coming out of the Wedgwood Institute was an individual we recently closed an exhibition on called John Lockwood Kipling, who taught industrial design and art in Burslem, in Stoke-on-Trent, and then came to South Kensington to help design the South Kensington Museum. His son was Rudyard Kipling, named after Lake Rudyard, a beauty spot just north of Stoke-on-Trent. And Lockwood would design many of the most beautiful illustrations for Rudyard Kipling's work. So the East India Company, the design school movement. And our third component was the circle of reformists and visionaries based around the incredibly handsome Prince Albert. Albert had Albert was a much more kind of radical anti-establishment character than we sometimes give credence for. And he couldn't bear the kind of landed, finance, entitled Anglican elite in England, who he thought had no conception of the kind of competition which was emerging from Prussia, from America, from France. And he wanted to build up British competitiveness by focusing on design and technology. And he worked closely with this wonderful man, Gottfried Semper. Semper was a refugee from the 1848 revolutions on the continent, who became part of Alfred's circle. And Semper believed above all that public museums had a particular role to play in this process of building competitiveness and citizenship. The museum would provide a repository, he thought, for superior examples of applied arts, while its buildings would themselves provide lessons in architectural style. And again, as we'll see, part of the story of the V&A is, yes, an account of the decorative arts, but their place within a remarkable architectural fabric. And this conversation which goes on in the museum today between architecture and the decorative arts. Semper had great confidence in the collections and monuments. He called museums, I always like this, the true teachers of a free people, reinforced by regular public lectures. So he was helping Albert think about how to establish systems and institutions to build competitiveness and citizenship. But as Albert always said, if you need steam, get coal. And it was Sir Henry Cole who, this great sort of go-to factotum of Albert's, who would provide the real kind of grit in the system. And here he is, directing his engineers and architects to build, as we'll see, the South Kensington Museum. And wonderfully, I'll come on to say, we've just built a new extension to the museum with a female architect, female engineer, female designer, and I'm trying to redo this picture with three female architects and designers. Cole set about setting up a series of public exhibitions in the late 1840s. And then in 1851, he got Albert's support to produce the great exhibition of the works of industry of all nations at London's Crystal Palace. This was the great display of, was meant to be the great display, as it was, of British technical and imperial and colonial might, but also within a global context. And once again, though, it set Britain thinking about the competitiveness that they were facing. And here you see the crowds wandering up and down the different pavilions, the different accounts of all the technological mastery of the day. And here you had the Indian court, you had Pugin's medieval court, as well as other nations, particularly the French, bringing their wares to wonder. And the official catalogues accounted what they were interested in. Raw materials, machinery, manufacturing, fine arts, the colonies, foreign states. And we thought, well, if we had a great exhibition today, what would be in our catalogue? So we thought artificial intelligence, architecture and climate change for volume one, technology, hacking and robots for volume two, and for volume three, social design, activism and art. From the 1851 exhibition emerged, first of all, this idea of Albertopolis. The great thing about the Great Exhibition was that it made a profit. And there is still, to this day, as I've discovered, commissioners of the Great Exhibition. And so what Albert and Henry Cole wanted to do with the profits of this is then build a campus south of Hyde Park to put together some of the great learning institutions, universities, museums, technical colleges, schools of music, schools of concerts, in a place that was known as Brompton, but the kind of estate agents didn't think that was very fashionable, so it became South Kensington while these developments took place. So this was open land in the early 1850s, upon which would be built the South Kensington Museum, Imperial College, the Natural History Museum, and as we'll see others, the Science Museum. Our museum is the South Kensington Museum, which opens in 1857. Previously, and this gives you an indication of what we were about, it was the Department of Practical Arts, which then became the Museum of Manufacturing, which then became the South Kensington Museum, within which was situated the Government School of Design. And right from the start, the V&A had a different ethos, focused on public access and improvement. So here is our wonderful dining room and restaurant, part of which was designed by William Morris. Because Cole wanted working people to come to the V&A to enjoy themselves, to have good food and good relaxation, and enjoy the artifacts. We were the first to have gas lighting so that after work, working people could again come to the museum, enjoy it, understand it, feel it belonged to them. But it was also about instruction and education. And so whilst on the one hand, the V&A showed, the South Kensington Museum at this stage, showed what was good design, it was also clear about what was bad design. And one of Cole's first exhibitions was known as the Chamber of Horrors, where he brought together an account of bad design. Amongst the many exhibits, and the chief criminal, was the convolvulus gas jet. And the original caption read, "Gas flaming from the petal of a convolvulus, one of a class of ornaments very popular, but entirely indefensible in principle." So this was As Cole says, there has arisen a new species of ornament of the most objectionable kind, which is desirable at once to deprecate on account of its complete departure from just taste and true principles. This may be called the natural or imitative style and is seen in its worst development in some of the articles of form. So the Chamber of Horrors was an account of what not to do, an account of what you shouldn't see. During the latter half of the 19th century, though, the collection begins to grow. And the gem of the collection was gifted by Queen Victoria in 1865, who always loved, as she put it, good Mr. Cole. She described him with his rough, offhand manner, so touchingly devoted to dearest Albert's memory. And she gifted the Raphael cartoons on long loan from the Royal Collection to the museum to give it the kind of collection boost it needed in the earliest days. The cartoons go right back to the 1620s in British hands, when the Prince of Wales, future King Charles I, purchased them in order to kickstart the tapestry industry at Mortlake. And these are regarded as some of the greatest works in this field because they were the cartoons, they were the studies for the Vatican tapestries by Raphael. And in the 18th and 19th centuries, they were regarded amongst the greatest works of art in Britain before the Elgin Marbles took over. And here we see the tapestries, which for a while were located alongside the cartoons, and here an imagery of one of the cartoons. Alongside that, the V&A was gifted during the First World War in the largest gift by a living artist to this day, Rodin's collection of sculptures and busts, which sit at the heart of our Hintze Gallery and our collection of sculptures. And then also our ceramics. Our ceramics is at I think it's the world's greatest collection. I'm not going to beat around the bush on this. Going back 2,500 years, particularly strong post 1500, and with a great collection of Wedgwood from Stoke-on-Trent as well. And recently, the V&A is now also the owner of the Wedgwood collection, which still sits at the Wedgwood Museum, quite rightly, in Barlaston. So we are the centre, really, for the study of ceramics in Britain, if not the world. So the collection grows during the latter half of the 19th century, but it's still the South Kensington Museum. And in 1899, on Queen Victoria's last public appearance, the museum is changed. She wanted to call it just the Albert Museum, but it becomes the Victoria and Albert Museum. And at this point, very interestingly, the Science Museum splits off, because prior to 1899, the V&A, as it were, and the Science Museum were one body. And that language of practical art and manufacturing meant that science and art stood together. In 1899, the two divide, and a new edifice is built by the architect Aston Webb for the building. And here we see the opening on Cromwell Road. And this is a much more kind of bullish Edwardian Baroque imperial architecture about Britain in the world. And the words of Sir Joshua Reynolds are plastered over the front. The excellence of every art must consist in the complete accomplishment of its purpose. And it's something we try to hold dear to every day. So what do we do behind the scenes? Well, we sell a lot of scones. last year, we sold 105,115 scones. We did over 345,000 coffees and 203,000 pots of tea. And I'm proud of that. I like the fact people come for tea and coffee. I like the fact people just come with their kids to play in the paddling pool in the middle of the Medeski Gardens. This is an open museum to the public. This belongs to them. Now, arguably in the 1980s, we went a little bit too far with some of this thinking. And this was the notorious advertising campaign about the V&A, an ace calf with quite a nice museum attached. And I don't think that landed very well, but I think the notion of public access and enjoyment remains incredibly important. Behind the scenes, we also have two memorials to Henry Cole's dogs, which I think is probably one too many. We also have a beehive, and they tell me the honey is very sweet because our bees have a particular affection for the garden of the Chinese ambassador, whose planting means that our bees are producing. They say it's lychees. I can't believe it's lychees. But our honey is rather sweet, and we sell it appropriately. What do we also do? We are a museum, we are a research institute, we're a teaching body, but we're also heavily involved in the conservation of 2.3 million objects in furniture, in textiles, in fashion, in paper, in books, in paintings, in sculpture, in metalwork, in ceramics, in glass. We have sensors watching the heat levels, the humidity, and then we have the incredible use of new technology in terms of X-ray facilities, but ultimately just the great hand and the gift and the understanding. And here's Michael, we'll come on to this, the plaster cast copy of Michelangelo's David, which Queen Victoria demanded a fig leaf be placed in front of. I've yet to find that fig leaf. I must ask where that still exists. Textile conservations, the dreaded bugs which infest some of our textiles. Here, hanging carpets in 1951, and here are the Cloth Workers' Centre for the Study and Conservation of Textiles and Fashion. We have a huge reserve collection at Blythe House in West London, and you'll go there and you'll see spread out over the study areas, sort of weird Pringle jumpers from the 1970s, which hipster students are coming to study. So we have this remarkable collection, which is there conserved, ready both for public access and for scholars to see. What we're also very good at is putting on special exhibitions. Here, the David Bowie Is 2013 exhibition. This has now been seen by 1.8 million people around the world. If you want an example of UK soft power, of the UK reaching out to the world, telling the world about modern Britain and the nature of design and creativity and innovation in Britain, this exhibition, drawing on the incredible archive catalogue of Bowie, is remarkable. Similarly, the Alexander McQueen Savage Beauty, we had to open all night at the weekend, to allow visitors to see this show. But at the same time, Opus Anglicanum, masterpieces of English medieval embroidery. We mix quite unashamedly the modern with the ancient, with the medieval, all based around the brilliance of our collection in terms of art, design, and performance. And our upcoming exhibitions, Balenciaga has opened. I never thought I'd begin to know about the envelope dress and the sack dress and the importance of the silhouette, but I do now. Opera opens in September. And then my favourite, plywood, the material that made the modern world. I think only the V&A could have a summer season which has Pink Floyd and plywood at the same time. At the same time, improvements to our permanent galleries. Here, the Europe Gallery. This is one of my favourite objects. This is a Dutch tin earthenware pagoda for tulips from Iran. So if you want a story of sort of globalization and east-west cultural flows and how that affects design, it seems to be a brilliant example. So we've been putting on exhibitions, we've been transforming our permanent galleries, and now we're beginning, in a sense, at the V&A to spread our wings further. This June, a new way in opens to the V&A. This is the Exhibition Road quarter. This is coming into the V&A from Exhibition Road, which has been blocked up for over 100 years, allowing a new gallery, but also a new way of understanding the museum. And remarkably, a new sort of public piazza with porcelain tiles on the floor. I'm just scared of the skateboarders, but I think it's going to be an absolutely stunning open public space in the heart of London, establishing, in a sense, the spirit of Albertopolis, going back to that vision of this open intellectual flow from the Royal Albert Hall all the way down to South Kensington. And we will then flow outwards here towards the Science Museum and the Natural History Museum. And here you see the great difference, in a sense, in the architecture. So this is what is now known as the Henry Cole Wing. And this was the mid-Victorian, very rich kind of Lombardy, Renaissance, Italianate style. And then here is the Aston Webb, the 1900 wing, a much more kind of bullish Baroque. And as I said at the beginning, the special nature of the V&A seems to me, this conversation that takes place between the architecture and the decorative arts. So that's what's happening in London. And in Dundee, we're opening a new museum of Scottish design. At an interesting time. So we are, as a British institution, creating a museum of Scottish design in Scotland, supported incredibly strongly by both the Scottish government and the British government. And Dundee, with its remarkable global history, again going back to the East India Company and to Jute and Calcutta, but also its contemporary story of both comics, video games, the schools of design there, in this incredible piece of architecture by Kengo Kuma, which stretches out into the Tay. There is a very active social media debate as to whether this is modelled on a Star Wars spaceship. It is not, but it will be a stunning work. More than that, it is an account of a museum invested in the local community. The levels of education working through the V&A Museum in Dundee is remarkable. And in October, we open new galleries in Shenzhen in China. This is a very interesting collaboration, a time-limited collaboration, which puts us at the heart of a debate in China about moving from made in China to designed in China. And Shenzhen is at the heart of the Pearl River Delta, near Hong Kong, Guangzhou. And this is where the designers and the makers of the Chinese future are. And just as the museum was involved in the Great Exhibition, that moment of transition from the First Industrial Revolution to the Second Industrial Revolution in the UK, so I think we're playing an interesting role in China, thinking about the same things. We have total intellectual freedom there. We have a great working relationship with designers and makers. And once again, it's a story, I think, of the V&A in the world. And finally, in terms of our spreading our wings and transitions forward, we are hopeful of moving also onto the Olympic Park in East London for a new museum there, which was known as Olympicopolis, but is now no longer designated as such, but focused particularly on design, on photography, on textiles. And again, it seems to me what our museum should be doing. There are too many kids in Newham, in East London, and actually in the coastal communities in Essex, North Kent, who will not go, as things stand, to the V&A in South Kensington. They don't know it exists. And yes, we'll do everything we can to bring them in, and our outreach work and our education work is phenomenal. But this is where the energy of so much of our future economy is happening in East London, and we need to be there. And it seems to me we have a role, if again going back to our roots about competitiveness, about industrial design, about citizenship, about education, that we should be on the ground in communities like Newham, like Tower Hamlets, like Dagenham, to make sure that museums have a relevance and a function in the modern world. So let me finally just say a few things about upcoming challenges. Part of the vision of Henry Cole and its first curator, John Charles Robinson of the V&A, was to create a collection of casts, which produced our cast courts, of major international works of art and architecture. So we have this incredible array of copies of some of the great works of European and global culture. And the ambition there was to allow working people who were not going to get to Athens or Rome or Florence or Venice to see these for themselves. And they are in themselves works of great technical capacity. And in 1867, Henry Cole produced an international convention on allowing the exchange of plaster casts, photography, electrotypes, to allow as many people across Europe to have access to this as possible. And it seems to us now that we need to redo this convention 150 years on, not least because here we see Palmyra being blown up by ISIS. We are seeing through the combination, whether it's terrorism, whether it's the pressures of development, whether it's pollution, enormous pressure on some global heritage artifacts. And at the same time, we have remarkable capacity for reproductions. So this is a digital reproduction of Veronese's wedding at Cana in the refectory in San Giorgio in Venice. Now, the original was ripped off the walls by Napoleon's troops in the late 1790s. And wonderfully, when in the aftermath of Napoleon's fall, Venice wrote to the Louvre to say, could we have it back now? The Louvre said, no, it's far too delicate to travel. But now, thanks to Adam Lowe and his technology at Artefactum, you can do a digital scan and a reproduction. And this reproduction, it sits where the original should have sat. So where is the original? What is the original now? Is it the one in the Louvre in this, you know, completely dispossessed environment? Or is it the one that sits where it was originally conceived for? And Adam Lowe calls it the migration of aura. Has the aura migrated from, as it were, the original to the reproduction because it's been placed back where it should? So this is an idea we're very involved with. Secondly, money. One of the big challenges for modern museums is raising money. We've had our grant and aid, our government support, cut by 15% over the last 6-7 years. A lot of museums have had a lot worse than that. So we need to go out in the world to make money. And this is where our exhibitions are touring now, around the world. And when we think of an exhibition now, we think above all of its merit, its intellectual, artistic, cultural merit, but also then of what kind of partnerships and what kind of audiences it might speak to around the world. And what we're always involved in is a mix of entertainment and education. Our incredible show, Pink Floyd, is on now. And this is not some kind of nostalgic car boot sale for old rockers. This is a brilliantly produced exhibition, not least through the kind of sound, but also a story of the cultural lineaments of Pink Floyd and their debts, as they see it, to Edward Lear, to William Morris, to Lewis Carroll, and how you fit that within an understanding of modern British culture. The perennial question, how do we manage our reserve collections and access to them? Quite rightly, I receive letters from people saying, you know, my great-granny gifted this to the V&A, why isn't it on public show? We can't put on public show 2.3 million objects. We rotate 100,000 a year, but we are also investigating how we open up our reserve collections to make sure that they become a kind of visitor experience as well. At the same time, what we're involved in is lending as much of our material to regional and local museums around the country. This is a list of national museums' performance indicators, their regional engagement. Oh, look, right at the front is the V&A lending more, quite rightly, as a national museum to regional and local partners. And for example, this September, we're beginning a big loan to the Herbert Museum in Coventry for one of their exhibitions on South Asia. New audiences and new interpretations. We are doing very good work, particularly on some of our LGBTQ tours and interpretation. We have more to do, much more to do, on Black Heritage tours and making sure both our staff and our audience and our collections are reflective of modern Britain. And there is an opportunity upcoming when we think about redoing our 19th century courts as to how we interpret more effectively, I think, our Africa collection. And then there's the big challenge of Brexit. Brexit is a very, very big intellectual challenge, but it's also a logistical challenge. We are involved in the movement of people, of objects, artifacts, day in, day out, between museums across the European Union. If we are holding those up, if they're becoming subject to visas and export entry requirements and all the rest of it, that is going to hold up the work of a museum. That is going to hold up the ability of us to put on the best displays possible. The Royal Opera House is even more worried. If their tenor gets a sore throat and they need to fly someone in within 24 hours' notice, having a sort of complicated visa entry requirement is going to be a nightmare. But we also have to acknowledge, I think, that part of the drumbeat towards Brexit was a sense of too many of our national institutions based in London being out of kilter with non-metropolitan, with regional, with coastal communities. And I think it behoves national institutions to make sure that we're talking to all parts of the country, where the Brexit vote was, where the Remain vote was, to make sure that we have an offer that isn't somehow distant, that isn't somehow not for the likes of them, that is more concerned with kind of, you know, Davos than Daventry. It is this kind of global institution. Yes, we've always been global, but we have to speak to the entirety of the UK. We are proud of our European heritage. We're deeply proud of our European heritage, but we also understand that within the context of Brexit, we have to make sure that we speak across the nation. And one of my responses to that as director is to make sure we go back to our roots supporting design education in schools. Art and design and technology is being stripped out of too many secondary state schools in the face of budget cuts, of accountability measures, and sometimes actually in face of parental pressure. Even though, ironically enough, jobs in the creative industries are going to be less subject to automation, to robotification? To the rise of robots than other areas. So teaching kids about design and technology is future-proofing them for the economy. And this is what we did in the 1830s and 40s, and this is what we've got to start doing again. So we're beginning this September teaching the new design and technology GCSE in Coventry and Blackburn, working with regional museums, coalitions of secondary schools and local industry to make sure that we at the V&A are doing our bit. Finally, some things of beauty. A beaker from Egypt or Syria, I think we think it's Syria, from the mid 14th century, which then became caught up in this wonderful myth that it was formed when fairies were caught having a drink and the glass was coloured. And they're here, don't worry about the Wolsey Angels, here we have one of the great names for a painting, Lifeboat and Mambi apparatus going off to a stranded vessel making signal of distress. And here you see the anchor there, and then it's flying over to haul them in. We have an incredible collection of turners and constables in our collection. I am always inspired every day by one of the sort of founding forces of the V&A, William Morris. Morris was a sort of external examiner for the V&A on our history of design course, and like most external examiners, he grumbled intensely. But he loved the institution. He designed one of the dining rooms. Suddenly, those chairs and tables don't look so nice in there, do they? And we are proud to have many of his block-printed wallpaper, his wall hangings. And what he thought was, above all, about the importance of utility and beauty, and how his socialism and his idea of ethical fellowship was built around a system of art, design, and beauty. And if you want to see a sense of that, then, ladies and gentlemen, come and see for yourself. Thank you. Now, I'm very happy to take questions, comments, or why the queue system in the cafe is always so strange and you can never get your cup of tea. Who would like to begin? Lady there. Oh, no, sorry, it's the lady behind you and then
sorry,
you.
Sorry, I have the mic. hi. I've been a fan of the V&A for a number of years. The V&A took me overseas because I was very inspired by its galleries, and the V&A has brought me back to the UK from New Zealand because it has got so much to offer. I've travelled quite a lot, and one of the things that distresses me in this country is that I go overseas and I pay a huge amount of money to see other European cities' collections for a large sum of money, and yet I can visit the V&A, the British Museum, and many museums over here free of charge, which I think is fantastic for the people, the citizens of the UK. But when I go overseas, I have to pay. Now, I'd be very happy to pay over here, except three quarters, according to the British Museum numbers, come from overseas. And therefore, when I have to go overseas and pay to see their museums, and people are crying out over here because obviously it costs a huge amount of money to look after what we have, I wonder why the British museums, V&A, all the museums inclusive, do not charge overseas visitors. I can understand we should be okay. Free to people in this country.
Okay. I think that's a perfectly credible argument, and there are kind of two responses to it, in a sense. One is, and I've raised this issue in the past, particularly because so many of our local authority museums are under such pressure. The V&A used to charge, and when it charged, it went down to about 900,000 visitors. We're now at 3 million visitors, and we make more on retail, on marketing, on licensing, that offsets the entrance charge. So in terms of our economics as a business model, it works for us. Secondly, it's a source of incredible attraction for people around the world to visit London. So in terms of sort of London PLC as a global city, and we're in competition with Berlin, with New York, Mumbai, it's one of the great selling points of coming to London. Now, there are some slightly dubious tour operators who say, included in the price of your trip, free entry to all London museums. there is a challenge with some of that. But from the V&A's perspective, and I think from my colleagues as well, a free entrance, rather than asking people for passports and all the rest of it, works. And it works particularly for UK citizens and people. I was struck on week two there, I was sort of introducing myself to various members of the public who didn't want me to introduce myself to them. But there was this young woman who worked at Specsavers, down near South Kensington, and she came into the V&A at lunchtime to wander around, and it gave her such joy, and that just that to me, I felt sort of, I felt the spirit of it. So it works for us. But thank you for your question.
Hi, you mentioned photography very, very briefly. The National Media Museum in Bradford is losing its collection to move down to London as part of some recent decisions. Do you want to explain a bit about how that's going to be managed in the V&A in London and what the implications are in terms of national consolidation further in London again?
Yes, so for those of you who haven't followed this, the Royal Photographic Society collection moved from London to Bath, and then in 2003 it moved from Bath to Bradford, and then under the control of the Science Museum in Bradford, it then, as a result basically of funding pressures in Bradford, where public access was being restricted, the collections weren't getting the kind of curatorial support they needed, not through a lack of ambition, but through a lack of resource, and the kind of digitization that we want to see for that collection for a global audience as well as national scholars wasn't taking place. So the V&A stepped in. The V&A have been collecting photography since 1862. We have the earliest photograph of London in our collection. And so now it is at the V&A, in our collections, being digitised, catalogued, opened, but it has come from Bradford to London. And it seems that, on the one hand, I would say that the collection is being looked after more effectively and being opened up more effectively, but you're stripping out elements of cultural capital from non-metropolitan areas. And so we as a national museum have a responsibility to make sure that we are then supporting regional and local colleagues, as I hope I showed, as I showed we did. And what we're particularly doing, it's beginning in Nottingham, is working on photography curators around the country. So yes, we have the collection, but we have a responsibility to make sure that access and interpretation and leadership then in non-metropolitan areas is supported within quite tight funding constraints, which is why it's come down to us. That lady there in the...
No, it was the same question.
Oh, OK. Oh, fine. Excellent. Shall we have someone over there? Yep.
Can you just explain why you thought plywood deserved its own exhibition?
One of the things you understand as a I'm getting to understand as a director is that you inherit an incredible back catalogue. So I'm beginning to think about commissioning exhibitions for at the earliest October 2019. So this wasn't my idea, but that is in no way. I am a plywood convert. that is in no way to deprecate this exhibition. This is going to, I mean, Pink Floyd is good, don't get me wrong, but the one to watch is plywood. We've got World War II bombers, we've got racing cars, we've obviously got sewing machine covers, we've got chairs, we've got so much made out of plywood, and we have this world-class curator, Christopher Wilkes, who is going to tell you the story of plywood as you never thought you wanted it to be told to you before. And you'll enjoy it.
Hi, I'd like to become a member of the V&A. Can you tell me about that membership?
I genuinely didn't plan that question. we have 80,000 members, and for £50 a year, you have free entrance to the exhibitions. You have an excellent magazine with not that hard-hitting interviews with the director, and you have access to all sorts of events, trips, and visits, and also opening in the autumn a new members' room. So it's a very good decision. Well done. Well done. What's there? Oh, up the stairs over there.
Thanks. You've talked about making the art more accessible for people in regional locations, but you didn't talk much about how technology can help you to do that. And so I'm wondering if you have strategies around using internet, social media, apps, etc., to make things accessible.
Yes. I mean, this is a really strong and active area of debate. In one of our new galleries, you can, on your iPhone, download your own personal guide to the contents of the galleries. And you know, it's done beautifully, there's music, there are the curators talking, but you're wandering around listening, you know, either with your headphones or listening to your iPhone whilst looking at the artifacts. And actually, it hasn't proved that popular. There is a sense of, people often coming into the museum as a way to get away from digital activities. And what we'll find is that they'll then go home often and, you know, want to look at what they saw today, or they'll be in the cafe looking at it. So they'll reflect afterwards through digital media and digital access on what they saw. But in terms of their own personal interaction with the object, often they want to step back from that. At the same time, what we're involved in is a massive program of digitizing our collections. But again, it's a debate. There's a very big debate in the museum world about the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the amount of investment they put into digitizing their collection, which means that you're taking it away from other areas. And so we're very passionate about it. We're strong on it, but we haven't. I don't think it's rather like the newspapers. No one's got the answer yet about what you should do. What I'm very passionate about is ensuring that we're giving teachers the professional development and advice they need to be able to access our collections online to inform their teaching. So if we pursue it through a more sort of education-focused lens, that would be my ambition. Do you want to come back on that? Do you have thoughts on that? Are you?
Just curious.
Okay.
Just curious, because I've been to MoMA and I saw a lot of the apps and technology that they had, and I guess I actually live in Perth in Australia, so I don't get to see many of these fabulous museums, and I'm interested in how technology can make things more available.
Great, okay, thank you.
Yes. Can I ask about your new acquisitions policies or strategies, and if you spotted any gaps in the collection? Well, apart from plywood, of course.
Oh, no, we're quite strong on plywood acquisitions. it goes to the point, actually. One of the areas we've got to get our head around is digital acquisitions strategy in terms of design and digital design. In terms of whether it's apps, whether it's websites, whether it's kind of... sort of capturing some of the social media. We're not a social history museum. We're an art and design museum. So we have to be quite critical about that and think about what we're collecting. But I don't think we've got the answer yet on what our digital acquisition strategy should be. I'm too new in the job to answer whether I think there are other gaps. I would feel deeply presumptuous in front of my keepers at this stage. But I can come back in the future and answer.
Hello. You spoke about art education in schools. We all know that huge art exhibitions in the V&A, in other galleries and places all around the country have huge audiences. As an ex-art teacher, I wonder what you feel we can do to persuade people that art is an intellectual as well as a creative and worthwhile area to study.
Creative
industries are so huge, and yet art is being destroyed in schools and in further education.
But it's a social justice issue, because In the independent sector, they're not getting rid of the art rooms or the kilns or the design and technology. Actually, they're doing more of it. And it's actually in the state sector where the pressures of... And I think it's the... You know, and this isn't a party political point, because since 2008, the numbers begin to kind of fall quite dramatically. It's the combination of budget pressures and the accountability measures. And it will only change when you shift that. The policy I suggested in a previous existence was that no no school could be rated excellent by Ofsted unless it had a full rigorous and testing curriculum, which basically meant if you had stripped out art and design, along with sport or drama or music, then okay, you could be nailing your maths and English gradings, but you're not going to get an outstanding because you stripped that out of the curriculum. So you have to have an inspection criteria which mandates leaders of schools to support it, but those leaders of schools are under real pressure with their budgets because if they haven't got enough kids taking the subject, then they can't put it on. So there's a finance issue and a kind of accountability issue, which I think should be solved. Last question. The question was, why did I take the job? I cannot believe, after sitting through 55 minutes of this, you don't know why I didn't take the job. Thank you very much.